You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Welcome to the Choose FI Radio podcast. Today on the show, we really wanted to explore this idea of choosing to work to allow you to give generously. Now, we can think of anecdotes at an individual level where people are incredibly generous. But I think when you look at the content that we produced up to this particular point in time, giving hasn't been something that we've spent a lot of time talking about. I thought that that was something that we could rectify today by bringing on Michael Peterson, who has an incredible story and highlighting his journey to financial independence. So much actionable content here. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing well. And yeah, it's a bit of an understatement to say that Mike has just this incredible life story. I mean, I'm just looking at the little sheet that we created beforehand, and he has a concession business that's been featured on Good Morning America. He's written a book. He was originally a CPA. He lives in a shipping container for half the year and in El Salvador for the other half.
You're spoiling the entire story, Brad.
But it's amazing. Dude, this is the most incredible thing. I want everybody to hang on every word. I mean, this is a remarkable, remarkable story. So with that, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
Well, thanks, Brad. You stole all of my thunder. I was going to let Mike answer a lot of these questions, but we'll see what we can do. I want to go back to the beginning. Mike, let's start with a grandfather that sells you a concession store when you're 12 years old. Talk about the ultimate side hustle. How does this happen?
Yeah, so I like to joke with my friends that we're carnies. We have a food concessions business, and I started working for my grandfather when I was 12 years old. It was kind of how I put myself through college and thought, you know, that would lead on to bigger and better things. I actually was planning on being a CPA. I was an accounting major, and I did an internship one summer for a company that makes food for McDonald's in their accounting department. And their accounting manager, he told me his one goal for me that summer was for me to find a different path in life, because he was very unhappy in what he was doing. And he was like, you got to do something different.
Don't become me.
Yeah.
I'm both laughing and crying on the inside, because I wish someone had done that for me as well.
But it was definitely true. I found that just being in an office all day, having to wear a shirt and tie and being stuck at a desk, I didn't enjoy it nearly as much as I had running my grandfather's concessions business, where I got to handle the numbers and the money and all that aspect. But I also was able to be outside and be more innovative and have a lot more variety to my day. My grandfather offered to sell it to me when I graduated from college, and then kind of went from there.
So, Mike, you said you put yourself through college with this concession stand, but does that mean just as an hourly wage? I'm trying to get a sense of the timeline and how you truly did that while, I guess, just as a worker at a concession stand.
Well, so it was my grandfather's stand, and it was just one aspect to his business. And so he basically turned that part of the business over to me. So I was making, you know, more than just an hourly wage. It was kind of we had like a profit share agreement. And so I was able to earn a significant amount of money during those summers.
Yeah, that's very cool. And you described the ability to be innovative. I'd love to hear how you did that in the concession stand business.
One thing that I've found in business is you don't want to try to be all things to all people. You want to find your little niche. And so that's what we've done in the business. We've always tried to push the edge. And sometimes we actually want to push people away from our product so that we find that unique niche that's really attracted to what we're selling. So we have one stand that's dedicated to bacon. It's called Bacon Affair. And we just do everything over the top bacon. So, you know, obviously we're not appealing to the vegans and the vegetarians and super health conscious group. We're going after the people that just want to enjoy life and eat bacon. And so,
and they are out there.
Kind of tried to, yeah. So we actually do a turkey leg. I don't know if ever anybody had a turkey leg at a fair or something before. So it's a 1.5 pound turkey leg. We actually wrap that with a full pound of bacon and then we slow cook it.
Brad, I think we're going to need to put some space between this episode and our episode 90, the vegan path to five. I think for everybody's minds, we'll just have to separate them out by a few weeks.
Oh man, Mike, go on. I want to hear more about this bacon wrapped turkey leg. Come on.
Yeah, it was something that was kind of over the top. Even people in the industry said, no, you'll never be able to sell it. You have to charge too much. And I'm like, you know what? People want something different. They used to say people eat with their eyes. Now people eat with their Instagram. They're looking for something. Literally, they're buying stuff just so they can post it on Instagram and look cool. And so we came out with this bacon wrapped turkey leg for $20 and we could not keep up. Wow. I mean, people were just lined up all day long for them. So it's just finding niches like that. And another huge product we do is chocolate covered bacon. So you get the sweet and the savory together, and it's just something different, something kind of blows people's minds. So
between your current business model and the pumpkin spice latte model of the world, I think you're accounting for a large percentage of gross domestic product here in the United States.
And Mike, you mentioned in their Instagram, you're in the concession business, but you're thinking about people's Instagram feeds. Have you seen digital media enter into your own business strategy in any other ways?
We definitely utilize social media in different ways, but more of it is about what is motivating people. It's not just our industry. They say, I was reading an article the other day about the travel industry and how many people decide where they're going to go based on what's going to look cool on their Instagram feed. Just to be able to see that shift and to see what motivates people and to be able to tap into that, I think is crucial in any business.
You know, just within the couple minutes that we've been talking, Mike, it strikes me that you have an entrepreneurial mindset. You see trends and you can very quickly act on those. I think if we look at how you've been able to look at those trends and get marketing around that, it's less of a surprise that you've been featured on Carnival Eats, the Travel Channel, the History Channel, and Good Morning America. I say it's less of a surprise, but at the same time, I'm fascinated by that because there are many concession stands that would dream of that sort of coverage. How were you able to position what you are doing in a way that was able to get that much attention?
I think it's part of it's just figuring out what the different media outlets, what they want, what's going to drive their viewership. So they want to be able to leave you with a tease about, you know, we're this concession stand that's doing deep fried Starbucks. That was actually one of our items 1 year that got us on Good Morning America and some of the other big media outlets. And before we were sent a cease and desist order by Starbucks. But,
you had a 2 month run there. It was great.
Yeah, we had a couple month run. But just to take something different. So, you know, we fried up Starbucks coffee beans mixed in a donut dough and we added some whipped cream and sugar. So you had that coffee, cream and sugar together. And it was a great product. But the best thing about it was just the hook. Like, how can you deep fry Starbucks? And so that was something that, you know, everybody kind of glammed onto.
It strikes me that you kind of see opportunities everywhere. And at the same time, just because we know that your grandfather sold you this business, this is a multi-generational thing. I'm curious, like, did you always know that you were growing up in an entrepreneurial family and that your path was going to be different than maybe the corporate 9-to-5? Or was it truly this individual that said, don't become me, that got you to take this entrepreneurial route?
No, I mean, since I was a young age, I was always an entrepreneur. I mean, I used to have like a paper collecting business. We'd collect everybody's newspapers and recycle them. I had a little red wagon when I was 5 years old and I'd go around the neighborhood. Everybody saved their newspapers for me. And then we turned it in, you know, once every 6 months. There was always little different things like that I was always looking for little niches to make money.
Jonathan, this reminds me of the conversation we had with Robert Farrington, right? Where we talked about people who had these amazing little entrepreneurial visions as kids, selling candy or reselling candy. It's so interesting to find more and more of these people who started way back when. So A, I just wanted to point that out. And B, Mike, how does your grandfather sell you this concession stand? Like, how does that work? And is that something that are you still, is this still your main source of income?
Yeah. So he came to me, it was my second semester of my senior year of college, and he was looking to focus on another aspect of his business. And he asked me if I wanted to buy this. And I thought, well, sure, I'll do it for a few years and then kind of go from there. Once I got into it, once I was the actual owner and was able to see the different growth potential and take it in different directions, obviously 20 years later, I'm still doing the same thing. So that went from being just a temporary thing to something that's enabled us to create a unique lifestyle.
And when you look at your family, your kids, I believe that, how many kids do you have, Mike?
I have two kids. I have an 11-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter.
Are they interested in A, the concession stand business as a family business? And then kind of B, part B to this question, do they have that entrepreneurial mindset as well?
They definitely have the entrepreneurial mindset. My wife and I want to be careful. We don't push them into doing something because we want them to do it. We want them to, you know, be able to explore what their giftings are. It has been great as a family. They do work in the business. There is a little loophole in the labor laws that if you have somebody in a family business and they're kind of doing like an apprenticeship, that they can work at an earlier age. And so we've been able to have our kids out there working with us. And it's just so great to see the growth that comes from that.
Nice. Funding those Roth IRAs, hopefully.
That's the plan this year. we're still working on that. In order for them to qualify for the apprenticeship thing, they're not technically supposed to be paid through that. So, but we do use their pictures on our stand and in advertising. So we're going to figure out a way to pay them for that in order to be able to fund the Roth IRAs.
Very cool.
So Mike, we are constantly talking about second generation FI. You have a family business. You have kids who are working in the business. Your kids are a little bit older than certainly my kids and Jonathan's and many people in the FI community. And I'm curious, how do you impart the wisdom of FI, if at all, in them? And how does that actually work on like a real granular level?
That's something we're still trying to figure out. My wife and I have had a lot of discussions lately about how much we let our kids in on the actual numbers and the different aspects of our financial life, that we want them to know that we've chosen to live differently for a reason. And that's so that we have more money to be able to give and share. And so we want them to kind of be able to contextualize that and see, you know, the way that we choose our housing, how that impacts our ability to give generously, the type of cars we drive, all those different things, how they come together. I think sometimes as a kid, you kind of look around and you make judgments about how people are doing financially based on the size of their home and the cars they drive and that sort of thing. And so we're trying to kind of explain to them the behind the scenes aspect of you can't judge a book by its cover.
And so these conversations have begun, is that correct?
Yeah, we've had, especially in the last few months, we've had a number of conversations as our kids are trying to understand our way of life and the fact that we do things differently. I think sometimes they think we must be super poor because they see, you know, the way we choose to live versus some of the way their friends live. And so we can have those interesting conversations about the life choices we're making.
A second ago, you said, you know, our kids might think we are poor. I'd love to explore that just a little bit further. Could you give us maybe a flavor for some of the life choices that you've actually made and the impact that's had on your family?
Yeah. So one of the decisions that we made when we decided to devote ourselves to our ministry in El Salvador was that it was silly to stay in our big home that we had here in California. So we decided to go ahead and rent that out. But we still needed a place to land when we returned here to work. And so we decided to build out what was a shed like they sell at Home Depot, the tough sheds. So we had a 20-foot by 20-foot tough shed and a couple sea containers. And I had always had this dream of turning this into some type of alternative housing arrangement. And so I somehow convinced my wife to allow me to do that. And so, yeah, now we live in a shed and a couple sea containers.
Okay, let's talk. Wait a second.
Yeah, we don't move on from that quickly.
All right. So I would imagine that if you do a storage container right, it would look very good on Instagram. So I get that angle. But let's like go back to what it actually means. So how big was your home that you were living in with your family originally?
So our home originally was like 2,700 square foot, had a pool. We were on 4 acres. It was, you know, a nice spread.
And I think you just said you're in a 20-foot by 20-foot storage container. Is that right?
Well, we have actually how we developed it. It's a 20-foot by 20-foot storage shed, and then two of the 20-foot sea containers that we've configured together to make our house.
All right, now let's go all the way back to the beginning of that and tell us how this happens. Who inspired you to do that? What was the cost to build? Like, there's a million questions here. Let's go back to the beginning of the storage container.
I'm not sure why, but ever since in our business, we use a lot of storage containers, and my mind's always spinning. It's like, man, you could live in one of these. And this started 20 years ago before you actually started seeing people build stuff out of it. So it had always been my dream to make it some type of housing. And as I saw more and more stuff pop up on the internet of people using things, it gave me different ideas. And so, yeah, we just combined the two sea containers and a shed to make it a pretty nice home.
Mike, so I obviously have a couple of follow-ups also. This is amazing. So you sold your house, your 2,700 square foot house on 4 acres of land. You sold that, as I understand it. And what land did you put this new housing arrangement on? So that's my real question. And also then as a follow-up is, what did people say when this happened? Like, did people think like, oh, they've fallen on hard times? Or was this a conversation sparker?
Well, we rented out our house. We have a big shop for our business on the same property as our 2,700 square foot home. So we did keep that and we rent that out. But when we decided to start building this out, people who know me well, just, it didn't surprise them. I'm always kind of trying to do crazy things. And yeah. So I think that for most people around us, it was definitely a conversation starter. When we first started, they looked at me like, you are crazy. And they looked at my wife like, we feel sorry for you, Brittany. But once we actually got it built out, people were wanting to come over and stay and take pictures. And they were pretty amazed at what we were able to do. The shed and the sea containers were actually already on my parents' property, who lived nearby where we were originally living. And so we actually just utilized these underused assets and turned them into a pretty nice place to live.
That's amazing. So your current living expenses are zero, close to zero. What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean they're pretty much close to zero. We kick in some money to my folks for the, you know, utilities and stuff that we use, but I'd say it's about $100 a month is our total housing and utility expenses.
Let's talk about utilities a little bit. So what does that look like to have these containers and actually turn them from just a static block of, you know, steel to something that actually has water and electricity? I mean, are you guys just bringing in water buckets? Did you actually run water lines? How does that work?
No, we ran all the utilities, and we really used the sea container aspects for more auxiliary things. So like the laundry room and office, storage areas. Sea containers, I found out, they definitely have a lot of limitations when it comes to insulating them and how they perform in different conditions. So I found that they're better to use for non-core aspects of your life.
You know, Mike, it strikes me that you're willing to make what to other people might look like a very unconventional choice. And I'm curious, like, if you were to reflect back on, you know, Mike, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, what allowed you to think like this? What moved your norm to the point where you say, you know what, I can move out of this 2,700 square foot home, and I'm willing to try and with my family try to live in these storage containers and just see how it goes. Like, how do you get there?
I think a pivotal point in my life was really my senior year of college. I had a few close buddies that I was living with, and we'd stay up late, you know, talking about our dreams for life and our plans. And we started talking to people who had graduated a few years before us, you know, people that we had been friends with and known well. And they were all on this hamster wheel, just super unexcited about life and always thinking, man, if I can just get the next raise, then I'll be happy. Or if I can just get enough to get into this house, then life will turn around. But you talk to them 6 months later, and then they'd be looking to the next thing to bring satisfaction. And so myself and these three other guys, we decided instead of going on to law school or graduate school or different things that we had planned, that we would spend the better part of a year traveling around the world, living with people in places off the beaten path and kind of trying to discover how people in the rest of the world were living and if there was a better way to live life and a more sense of adventuresome, purposeful life out there.
So When you say we traveled to other parts of the world, were there any particular key spots that you spent a significant amount of time that you could highlight for our audience?
I mean, it was kind of a whirlwind trip. We drove down through Mexico into Guatemala. We were in the far north of Russia, across India, Bangladesh, Thailand. It was an amazing trip. I mean, to be traveling with three other guys on this adventure of a lifetime was huge. But the one thing that we found that even in the midst of that adventure, life starts to get stale and boring. If you do something enough, it loses its edge and you start to become dissatisfied. And so where we had originally thought maybe life is just about seeking adventure, we found that that would be almost as empty as just seeking material gains. And so we started looking at the lives of the people we were able to spend time with and seeing that kind of this true purposeful life that we were looking for is really rooted in being in a tight-knit community and about pouring yourself into something outside of yourself. And so that was kind of set the stage for me of what we wanted our life to look like, that it had to be about giving back and it had to be about being in tight-knit community.
Mike, I really want to dive into your thought of that adventure gets stale. I think for so many people, they view world travel as this amazing adventure and they could never get tired of it. And whereas to hear you talk and also to hear Brandon from the Mad Scientist had a recent podcast on his second year of early retirement, and it's echoing the same thought that while it sounds great to have this wonderful adventure and what you'd always dreamed of, what really matters is, like you said, having that tight-knit community, giving back, or having goals. Like in Brandon's case, it's having this routine, having goals for both his website and for, I guess he's working on a strength regimen and he's just trying to get better. And I think maybe that's part of it also is just trying to get better in some way. And to tie back to your life, at what point in that adventure, in that year, did that become obvious to you that you couldn't just do this and it retain the same excitement?
I think it was towards the end of our 6-month trip as we were kind of talking about how we were going to take this back into everyday life when we returned to the US and just realizing that the amazing part of the trip was not so much the crazy adventures and the cool places we got to see or cool things we got to do, but it was really becoming close with a small group of friends. And then also being able to really become entrenched in communities around the world and see the way that they live their lives are so much more intertwined than life in the US. In the US, we have so many choices. We can go to church, 20 miles this way. We can work out 20 miles this way. We can send our kids to the best school, that's over on the other end of town. And a lot of times we miss out on that community that comes from just daily interaction with each other.
I think what you're describing is really a simpler life. And I'm curious, we talk about anchoring, we talk about the impact of the influence of those around you. What did it do to your psyche from an anchoring perspective to be in these places interacting in the local community for 6 months?
We knew it on a hypothetical level that material things are not that important. But I think when you're living in the midst of some of the poorest people in the world, and seeing how full of joy they were and how full of purpose, it really reminded us to not get caught up in that hamster wheel.
What strikes me is that in your case, very specifically, you came back and it wasn't just a hypothetical, but it changed the course of your life because you guys are now doing volunteer work in El Salvador for a large portion of the year, essentially having a lifestyle by design. But what's so unusual about it is, and this is something that just captivated my attention for you, work is no longer about reaching financial independence. You've reached financial independence easily, but now work is a way to produce income to allow you to give. I would love to kind of slow down and explore your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my goal has never been to retire early in life. I always want to be active. I always want to keep moving and to be able to use the giftings that I feel I have. I think when you stop using your gifts, you stop living. And so for me, it was never about being able to retire, but I wanted to have that margin in my life so that I could be purposeful in what I'm doing, that I could choose what I wanted to do, not based on income limitations, but on what I felt I was called to be doing.
And Mike, what does this life look like for you?
Yeah, so now that looks like for our family, we come back to the U.S. and we work basically May through August. And that's when we're able to both supply our own income needs, but also supply a lot of the funds for the ministry we're involved in El Salvador. And then usually in September, we head back down to El Salvador, and we have actually formed an organization there that supports all people doing all kinds of different work in El Salvador. People that are working with the gangs there, people that are working with women who have been victims of sex trafficking, people who have started churches, people who have kids' homes. And so we've formed this umbrella organization that we actually help them have a more significant impact by helping them be more efficient behind the scenes.
So, Mike, for these 6 or 7 months a year that you live in El Salvador, are you truly a member of the community? Like, do you live in just a town or a village with neighbors that you've known now for years? Like talk me through what your actual day-to-day life looks like.
Yeah, so we live in a small coastal community called El Zante. I love to surf, so that's part of the reason we chose that location. It has a great wave for surfing. And yeah, daily life is entrenched with the local people. There's also some other expats that live there. And so our kids are able to go to a very small bilingual school. When I say very small, like 10 kids. But there's a Canadian family there. There's a family that's the husband's from Belgium, and the wife is local. And there's an American guy who's married to a Salvadoran, and they have a couple kids. And so our kids are able to participate in this bilingual school there. They can walk there from our house. We spend every evening on the beach, you know, watching the sunset. So it's definitely a slower pace of life, and you definitely feel rooted in the community.
Yeah, when you were describing your initial year of travel with your three buddies, you were saying how you felt there were so many more tight-knit communities in these places around the world as compared to the U.S. And I was hoping, just for my own edification, that you could kind of compare and contrast your normal day or week in the U.S. and California with how much you would interact, or if not yours, then let's say just the standard middle-class person, and how much you would interact with family and friends versus in where you live in El Salvador.
I think the biggest factor is just in most of the world, you don't spend time in a car. You don't drive to get places. So most life happens within walking distance of your home. That is just not the way life happens in the U.S. We have so much choice. We have so much opportunity that it leads to very fragmented lives. In most of the world, 95% of their lives happens within walking distance. And so because of that, you're rubbing shoulders with the same people every day. You can really notice when people are having issues or problems. People can't hide that because you're living in close proximity. And it really just changes the flavor of everyday life.
Mike, I wanted to come back and talk just for a few minutes about generous giving, which I know is something that you've expressed a passion for. But I'm curious, where did the impetus come for this? It seems like now it's driving more and more of the actions that you and your family make. And I'm curious where it started and what giving means for your life and your family's life now.
Sure. I think that my desire to give was something that was nurtured by my parents from a young age. We grew up in the church, and there was always encouraged to be able to give back 10% of what you made, so that the church could use it to minister to the poor and for other, you know, other needs. And so even from a young age, I would always set apart that, you know, that amount. As I got older, I realized that I wasn't limited to that 10%, that there were so many needs available, and that spending money on other people brought so much more enjoyment than just buying things. And so the older I got, the more I decided I wanted that to be a huge focus of our life.
Spending money on other people brought so much more enjoyment than buying things. That's really powerful. Talk me through the first time you realized that and like what that actually did for you internally.
I think even from a young age, just seeing, you know, even as a kid, to be able to give to things that, you know, were able to buy somebody a meal or meet a small need, it, you just felt like you were able to be part of their life. And there's never buyer's remorse when you give money away.
And Mike, it strikes me that you're hitting all the five boxes, right? So we have travel, it's a huge component of your life. There's a form of house hacking going on currently between you and your parents. Geo arbitrage, you have seasonal work. I mean, you have this life by design. This is not my position, but it's kind of a straw man, but I want to put it out there. Generous giving, in theory, would slow down your path to financial independence. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Have you reflected on that at all? And, you know, kind of how do you weigh that out?
I think that is the problem. A lot of people start on the path to FI. They're so focused on the destination that they don't think about the journey. And I think if you talk to a lot of people who have reached FI, they'll tell you that it was not quite as satisfying when they got there as they thought it would be. They really start to question what their purpose for getting up in the morning is. They have to really wrestle through some things and kind of rearrange their life. And so I would encourage people not to be so focused on the destination, but to be able to enjoy the journey while they're getting there. And one of the best things about the FI lifestyle is it gives you so much more financial margin in your life that you are able to be generous with other people. And in the long run, that is going to impact your life much more than being able to retire early.
Yeah, I certainly agree on the value of generosity and how wonderful it feels to give to causes and people and et cetera, that you care about. So that's something that my eyes have been open to that much more in the past year or two, certainly as we've reached financial independence and we have some more discretionary income basically to spend as we see fit. So I along the lines of what you're saying, Mike, I wish I would have done that years ago, but it's nice to come to that realization nonetheless. So I'm curious, is this the life that you plan on living for the next 50 years? Like, is El Salvador, is that the place for you? Or do you ever foresee a time where this generous giving goes and takes you someplace else in the world?
I mean, we love El Salvador. That's where our heart is. But I also love new challenges and new experiences. So I definitely could see us being taken in a different direction. And that's one of the huge benefits of living a FI lifestyle, of keeping your expenses low, of having that financial margin, is you have the ability to change course and to do different things. And kind of back to what we were talking about earlier, I think a lot of people think that they'll start giving once they hit FI. But life doesn't change once you hit FI. If you don't have those kind of habits in place, it's going to be very hard for you to change later in life, especially when you don't have an income coming in. A lot of times people, when they no longer have an income, they become more closed off and they become more of a sense of, well, we need to protect what we have. And so I would just encourage people to develop those habits of generous giving while they still have their income. And the other aspect is you never know if you're going to get those opportunities later on. Right now, you may have an opportunity to really impact somebody's life when they're young and change the trajectory of their life. You don't know if you're going to have that opportunity later on.
Man, that is so powerful. And I really appreciate you taking the time to explore that with us. I have a follow-up question about this idea of lifestyle by design. So you have this amazing seasonal business that you've developed, but increasingly, like once you've reached financial independence and probably well past what you really need, it seems like there's a possibility that maintaining that business would be just optional. Have you ever considered selling it? Is this something that you always plan on having for your kids? I'm just a little bit curious about how big of a role this concession stand is in your life now.
I tend to be a restless person. I'm always contemplating, you know, different paths that we can take. And so it's funny that you ask, because this is kind of an ongoing struggle with me is, you know, should we keep doing the business here or should we devote, you know, all of our time to El Salvador? And, you know, there's big trade-offs either way. Coming back and working gives us the financial flexibility to be able to do things with our ministry that we wouldn't be able to if we didn't have that business. And it gives our kids an opportunity to work at a young age, which is a huge gift.
Hey, Mike, I just wanted to go back real quick to the not-for-profit organization that you started and I guess run in El Salvador and talk about generous giving on a personal level, but also on more of a macro level. Maybe it's some, I don't know, limitation with my own mind or something, but I'm thinking about how do you scale that? And I guess then my natural follow-up is, does he even want to scale that? Maybe being there on the ground and helping people that you see is much more impactful for you personally. But I'm curious, have you thought about expanding the scope of that organization?
Yeah, that's how my mind works. And that's how I'm driven, is to grow things. I've also seen that a lot of nonprofits encounter what they call mission drift, where they start getting into all these other things that are outside of their strengths. And so I want to make sure that we stay true to our core values and what we're designed to do. Part of what makes that easy is what our organization does is it behind the scenes helps other organizations operate more efficiently and be more impactful. One of the things that I saw as we started to get to know some of these organizations working in El Salvador is they're basically like small businesses. They have goals that they're trying to hit. They have payroll that they have to be able to make every week. They have funding they need to raise for different things. And they have objectives that they need to hit in the most efficient way possible. And some amazing, good, great-hearted people running these things. But a lot of them don't have a business background. And sometimes we're doing things in a way that wasn't super efficient. And so part of what our organization does is try to help bring best practices into that realm, help connect them with other people that are doing things well, and then also just providing a lot of on-ground support to make sure they don't burn out and wind up having to leave the country because they're not taking care of themselves personally. So because of that, I feel like we're able to have this huge impact on the country as a whole just through our one little small organization.
That's cool. I love that concept of impact, and it can be in a variety of different ways. That's the beauty of taking that talent stack that you have and not only helping personally, but then helping other organizations. So that's really brilliant. And hey, Mike, I just have one last question, and this is about generous giving just in general. So not everyone who's listening to this obviously is going to live in El Salvador for 7 months a year and devote a third of their income to giving. And, you know, many people who are listening to this are members of churches. Many people aren't. And I think clearly, as you described, for people in churches, that 10%, that tithe, goes to many admirable and valuable things. And that's a logical way to give. But maybe for people who aren't involved in churches, how would you describe, like, what do you think is a great way to enact this generous giving in their lives today?
I think almost all of us have situations on almost a daily basis, people we see in need, different opportunities that come up where we can use our own financial resources to meet needs. It doesn't have to be through an official organization. I know for me, a lot of my giving is driven by my personal beliefs and a belief that we were designed to give back and that should be part of what our core is. But you look at even just secular research, it shows that people who give are happier. There's really nothing more efficient you can do with your money as far as your own personal happiness than to give it away. And so I think there's all kinds of great causes. We give the stuff outside the church. We're involved with donating to 4-H, some veterans organizations, a wide variety of different things we like to give our money to.
It just strikes me that if you were to look at purpose, identity, connection, you have that in spades. And I love that you were willing to come on the show and share your story with us. It's such a value add, frankly, for the community at large. Mike, what is the best way someone hears about this? They want to find out more about your organization. They want to find out more about your work. Maybe they just want to connect with you personally. What's the best way for someone to reach you?
Sure. So we have a website. It's missionaryfellowship.com. And there is a tab on there that you can send me a message. So that's the best way to interact with me. We're on the road a lot a bit and moving from place to place. So sometimes it may take me a week or two to get back to you, but I always respond.
Well, in most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, Mike, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I am. I'm excited.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Mike, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Well, I have a confession to make here. I'm not a huge blog reader. I usually like to spend most of my time reading books. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and I'm going to name my favorite podcast. And it is actually you guys.
Yes.
I really,
We made it in our own hot seat. That's the best thing ever.
I really got into podcasts this last year. Just it's a super efficient way if you're driving somewhere or doing something else to be able to not just listen to music, but be able to listen to something meaningful. And I don't know what it is, but something about the way you guys work together, it's just really been impactful on my life. Even when you interview other guests who have their own podcast, I feel like they are better on your podcast than they are on their own podcast.
You just made my day on so many levels, Mike. You have no idea. Thank you for that. Question number two is your favorite article of all time. And if that doesn't serve you well, and I'm giving you some flexibility here, you can very easily pivot that and make it your favorite podcast episode of all time.
I'm actually going to do something I usually don't do, but I'm going to pick something that I wrote myself. Like I said, I don't read a lot of blogs, but I at one point was trying to address an issue that a lot of missionaries face when they talk to people about how much money they raise. So I wrote a blog. The title was, "Why the Heck Would a Missionary Need So Much Money to Live in a Poor Country?" I had never written a blog before. I didn't know what they were supposed to look like. I did everything wrong, including having a title that was like a paragraph. But somehow this thing took off and we had like 200,000 people read it in the first month. And
wow,
it was amazing, the visceral response to, I mean, I had a lot of hate mail for the things that I wrote, a lot of great comments, but it was
very polarizing.
Yeah. It was very polarizing, but it was, I felt it was something that needed to be addressed because, and you guys talk about it some on your show about geo-arbitrage. And I think that's something that there's a lot of misconceptions out there. People think that it's super cheap to live in other parts of the world. And there are aspects of that, but honestly, the cheapest place to live in the world is the US.
All right, let's explore that a little bit further. Tell me, what does that mean?
The US, there is such an abundance. I mean, almost any material thing is going to be cheaper in the US than it will be in any other part of the world. Even utilities are cheaper in the US than they are in any other part of the world. So all these sites like International Living that talk about how cheap it is to live in other places, if you really drill down and look at the examples that people are talking about, it's because, well, yeah, they moved from a 3,000 square foot house. Now they're living in an 800 square foot apartment. They no longer drive. They take the bus places. They shop in the local markets. They've made all these life changes. So it's not that the country itself is less expensive. It's that the life changes that they've made make their life a lot less expensive. Now, most of them wouldn't have been able to do that if they still lived in the US because there's too much peer pressure and too much expectations. But the path to FI is so much easier in the US than it is in anywhere else in the world. It is unbelievable. Until you've really spent a significant amount of time outside the US, you don't truly appreciate that.
Mike, it strikes me that essentially what you're saying is if you try to port over the exact life that you're living now in, you know, anywhere in the United States to another country, it's going to be more expensive. Part of the reason that geo-arbitrage is so powerful is that you're forcing yourself, you're creating these parameters around yourself to adjust what your new norm has become vastly different and vastly less expensive. That's kind of the implicit power of geo-arbitrage. The reverse of that is that seeing how people live in the rest of the world frees you to do things that nobody in the United States would even consider. You're living in a storage container with your family for several months out of the year because your anchor point is so vastly different than maybe mine is right now.
No, that's for sure. And that is what really frees people when they move overseas and why their living becomes so much cheaper and a lot of times more healthy also, because they make huge lifestyle changes. But they could actually take that new lifestyle and move back to Ohio or some other low cost of living place and actually live much cheaper than they could in the foreign place that they're living.
You've like exploded my brain. You've given me so much content to think about over the next couple months. I'm sure we will hear another iteration of this on a Friday roundup, but that is really, really cool. Let's go ahead and go into question number three, your favorite life hack.
My favorite life hack is the donor advised fund. I know you've had some people that have mentioned that on past podcasts, but you cannot overstate what a valuable vehicle that is, especially for people where giving is a very important aspect of their life. And I love the donor advised fund. you can use it in the very simple ways of, you know, just donating appreciated stock, and you don't have to take that capital gains, but you're able to get the full write-off. But there's also some kind of crazy, wacky strategies you can use also.
Yes, we want to talk about the crazy, wacky strategies. Roll that out.
So one thing that, and this, like I said, this gets off into the weeds a little bit, but say you had planned to give $20,000 next year to a charity, and your one choice would be to just put that money aside and to, you know, in a year, go ahead and pass it over to them. You would get a $20,000 write-off, and that would be, you know, a done deal. Simple. But another more intricate strategy would be to invest that $20,000, $10,000 into one strategy and $10,000 into another opposing strategy, and to find vehicles where they have an inverse correlation so that when one goes up, the other goes down. So that even after a year, if you still have that $20,000, you now have one, you have a $10,000 loss, tax loss that you can take, and you have a security or a asset that you can donate and take that full $20,000 write-off.
I feel like I need to run this by my accountant. Brad?
Yeah, that might be a masterclass for a separate episode. But I think kind of if I can just interject with another strategy that I think is really pertinent to most people, is that with the new standard deduction being so much higher, it's now $24,000 for married couples, that putting all of your charitable giving, and this is actually where I thought you were going with this, into one calendar year. Let's say you knew for 2018 and 2019, you were going to give $10,000 each year. You can put both of those years worth of giving into 2018 and actually get to take the tax deduction, as opposed to in 2019, if you didn't meet the threshold for itemizing deductions, then that tax deduction would essentially be worthless. You would just get the standard deduction. So I think being able to have the assets to be able to do that from a cash flow perspective is really important. But to be able to kind of game that out ahead of time and get the full benefit for this donation that you're making anyway, I think that's really important.
No, that's a huge, definitely a huge advantage. And a lot of people don't realize you can donate cash to a donor advised fund. And we do that quite frequently. And that allows you to time your donations in the years where you have more income that you're trying to offset, but you have, you know, years and years to distribute those. So if you have a year where you have some huge one-time gains, you can offset those with a big donation in that year, but you can take the next 10 years to, you know, to give that money away. So it definitely helps with the practical aspects of planning, but also getting that tax savings.
You remember back in the day when it was just 10%. No, my friends, the rabbit hole goes much deeper.
All right, Mike, question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
My biggest financial mistake was not returning a library book.
Oh yeah, that's dangerous. Tell us more.
So this particular library book, which ironically was How to Write a Business Plan, that was the library book that I checked out. I neglected to return it. And it wound up costing me probably about $10,000 over time.
No way.
What?
Well, I did not realize that I had not returned this. The library book actually sent me to collections. And when I went to apply for a loan for some business assets, it actually jacked up my loan rate significantly because I had this collections notice on my credit report. So not only did I have to pay the collection fees and the, you know, which was minimal for this library book, but it actually cost me thousands of dollars in extra interest over the next 5 years after that, before it fell off my credit report.
How is that possible? Like where doesn't the word settlement come into play anywhere in here? Or like cost of book plus fee or something? Like,
well, it's
the add-on effects, Jonathan.
So it wasn't the actual cost of the book. I mean, I had to pay for the book and the collection fees. It was like $100. But the fact that it had dropped my credit score and I was no longer getting that prime credit rate because I had a collections.
Okay.
They don't care what the collections is for. If it was, you know, defaulting on a car or anything else, to them, it's just a collections.
But it's a separate product. Like the $10,000 wasn't related to the book. It was the downstream effects of not having as good of credit as you would have had. Okay.
Exactly.
Huge, huge sigh of relief for me and for the thousands of librarians out there that are thinking, wait, I have a fix for that. You can do this. I just wanted to double check.
but this is real, Mike. I mean, we had something similar to this when we got our mortgage recently, where there was some like absurd collections thing on my wife's credit report that like wasn't even real. And long story, but her credit score dropped, at least until we figured this out. But in the meantime, it had put us into a higher category for our mortgage interest rate. And luckily, I was able to, I think we essentially took her off, and it was just on my credit, and we did get it down. But this was, I mean, that was a very real concern. To your point, that would have cost us many, many thousands of dollars over a 30-year mortgage. So I think, you know, we all need to be very vigilant about our credit reports. And that's why having a good credit score is so important.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people will do all kinds of work to save, you know, $20 on gas or something like that. But, you know, there's these small things that actually have huge impacts on the long run that a lot of people just blow off. And so I learned that lesson kind of the hard way, that I need to keep up on my credit score and how important having a good credit score is.
All right. Question number 5, advice you would give to your younger self.
This is not all that revolutionary. I know some of your other guests have said the same thing, but not trying to beat the market. I took an investments class in university. We read the book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and I believed it. I bought in. I understood all the reasonings, but I still thought I was the exception. I was smarter. I could beat the market. And so I was going to prove that. I wasn't willing to risk my wife's retirement and her money, but I was willing to risk my own. And so I basically set up, I handle both of our accounts. And so I put all of her accounts into index funds. And with mine, I did all kinds of different crazy strategies with options and different things. And yeah, so 20 years later, she has significantly more money in her retirement account than I do. And that's even with me having put more in than she did. So it was definitely humbling to see that all that time, all that energy, all those emotional ups and downs, and for that, I have less money. So
I got to say that I think probably last year I talked to maybe 3 or 4 individuals, and this particular conversation led us into the topic of options. And with each one of these individuals that were talking about it, it was just how much more money could be made with these option strategies. And it struck me somewhere along the way that there is a survivor bias here. The people that are doing options and have crushed it for a period of time want everybody to know about it, right? But the people that own Bitcoin and lost half their money slink away and you never hear from them. I mean, it's just, that's just the reality that, and this isn't a topic on options. I'm sure that someone will email us saying that, you know, there is a way to do this to significantly outperform for minimal risk. We'll get those types of emails. But it's to say that rarely do you hear from the people that have these cockamamie schemes where it fails. You just don't talk about it as much. And that should be a cautionary tale for people. I think one of the things that we're a big fan of, like you just highlighted here, I don't need to have 200x the market. You know, I'm just trying to keep up with the market. If you look at the returns over time, it's really sad when you just fail to keep up with the market because you are trying to put more time in. You are trying to be more creative. You are willing to take more risk. And so, I mean, I just appreciate you being willing to share that and highlight it. Now, Brad, do you want to go for the bonus question?
Yeah, sure. Mike, we have a bonus question for you. And we talk in the FI community a lot about cutting expenses and being mindful about where we direct our resources. And a lot of times that is on the, cut things out. But that said, purchases add value to our lives. And I'm curious, what is the single purchase in the last, let's say, 12 or so months that has added the most value to your life?
Honestly, I'm not a big purchase person, so I'm going to cheat a little here. It will still be an Amazon purchase, but I'm going to talk about a book that I read this last month that has really impacted my life and even how I view things and how I think through things. So I hope it's okay if I cheat a little there. But the book is The Molecule of More. And Brad, if you have not heard of this book before, you have to get it. You're always talking about those little dopamine hits and how those motivate us in life. Well, this whole book is about dopamine and its impact and how it actually drives our motivations and how we live our lives and why even people have different political views is a fascinating book.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. I'm literally at my library's website trying to reserve it, hoping that it's there. So
wait a second. Yeah, you're not on cool. Amazon reserve. You're at your library first. Your first stop was to see. Brad, you are so consistent. You're so consistent. I love it.
just make sure you return it when you're done with it.
Actionable takeaway for the day.
That's fantastic.
Hey, Mike, thank you so much for being willing to come on the show. This has been great.
Yeah, no, it's been my pleasure. I love listening to your guys' show, and I love seeing people really thinking through these things and being more intentional about the way they're living.
Brad, if the path to financial independence is really about the journey, then giving has to be a mainstay of that experience.
Yeah, I agree, both for the community and for the individual. And I think Mike did a good job of explaining the benefit that it's brought, not only to the people that he's helping, but to him psychologically, right? And like how much satisfaction he derives from helping other people. And that doesn't diminish what he's doing. It, to me, it heightens it. This is wonderful all around. And I know, like I mentioned, I've seen little bits of this, and certainly probably 1% as much as Mike has, but it's real and it's powerful. And doing good for other people does good for you too. I think people need to be more aware of that. And I think this episode really highlighted that.
All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to chooseFI.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.